Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
On our show today, Christy, we're talking to Dr. Savinir Lehr, head of the North American region of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, about a recent important article she wrote in the Journal of the American Medical Association about occasionally breaking the rules might result in better healthcare. What do you think?
I think it's exciting. Let's break the rules and make it better. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk first about a video game synced with anesthesia for surgery and reducing stress for kids. Just reading this and thinking about this makes me think about my children when they go to get dental work. If they get now just a little bit of video on the screen in the ceiling, and then they put the little bit of stuff in their nose to kind of relax them, and it's a whole different experience. It's actually, children look forward to something like that. This is something where they looked at what they call first bedside entertainment theory, where patients watch movies and other entertainment. But in this particular thing, the new interactive experience is to get the patients to breathe in the anesthesia through this interactive game.
Yeah, they called it, as you said, Bedside Entertainment Theater, or BERT. In this game, they were watching Sevo the Dragon. I would like to do that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, why is it only, you know, showing the kids something before they put to sleep? I don't know if you've ever had surgery, Christy, but I had to have my knee operated on, and I had general anesthesia. No one's really, I think, looking forward to going under general anesthesia. And something that would just kind of take my mind off, it seems like you could be watching something like that, and this is what they did.
Right. So the kids got to choose a dragon avatar and choose a food for the dragon to cook using his fire breath, and then the patients would breathe the different food to help heat it up, or it was like a breathing activity that then they would just fall asleep doing it. So it'll be exciting to see how this impacts surgery stress for kids, and hopefully in very positive ways.
Yeah, I like the way they said the anesthesiologists used the cues. They went 1, 2, 3, roar.
I know, it's very cute. Okay, now let's talk about older kids or young adults in undergraduate education. And this is a study with what we've kind of known before, that early morning classes are difficult for college students.
Well, and I've got two kids in college right now, and let me tell you, they don't look forward to 8 o'clock classes, and I'm not even sure they make it to the 8 o'clock
class. I don't think I made it to mine.
But we know that in high schools, really started making classes start at 8:45. They didn't make it start at 8 because they knew that the kids actually, not only were they not ready and awake, they actually performed worse. And this is some research that was actually in the journal Frontiers in Human Neuroscience that looked at, well, maybe college students shouldn't be starting then. Seems like a good study to me.
Yeah, they surveyed 190 first and second year college students, and they analyzed the relationship between sleep and cognitive functioning from a neuroscience perspective, and basically found that up to 83% of students would be at their best performance if colleges allowed them to choose their own ideal starting time to still have a regular 6-hour day of classes, but to be able to choose and adjust to a later time based on their own needs.
And I suspect that you get to choose because you choose the classes you go to, but there may be certain classes that are only offered at 8 a.m. So I don't know how well it works to say, you know, you get to choose your classes. But increasingly with these classes that are kind of these online classes, you certainly might be able to. And you certainly don't have to make a rule that they have to start later. But they should take this research and have some serious discussion. I think if I were an administrator at a small college and I could implement some of these things, I might try some experiments 1 year from the next and see what happens. That would be
break the rules.
That would be breaking the rules.
It would.
I like it.
A little foreshadowing. Okay. We're next talking about new medication, or it's an overlooked medication, that can be used for postpartum hemorrhage or bleeding after childbirth and potentially could save many moms.
Yeah, you know, we in industrialized, developed countries, we have certain ways that we do things. If a woman has a postpartum hemorrhage, they may get a common drug called oxytocin. They may have like some manual massage of the uterus to try to slow the breathing down. But one of the things we don't realize is that 100,000 women around the world die of blood loss after a baby is born. It's the biggest cause of maternal death worldwide. That is, it's like I don't think about that very much. And how do we get the drugs that maybe they need that are maybe inexpensive and pretty effective? That's the question they sought to answer.
Yeah, we still have far to go. This particular research is around a medication called tranexamic acid, which does show the decreased risk of death from blood loss associated with childbirth and could reduce it perhaps by a third. And so this is research supporting that. It's exciting to have a new option for us in America. It's unclear to me, and I need to learn more about how this fits in when you have Pitocin and Cytotec and Methogen and Hemabate and all the medicines that
we use. You're throwing some big terms out.
I'm throwing out. We have all these different medicines that we can use.
Transexamic acid is also
a big word.
Big word.
But the point being, when we already have medicines that usually work, does this add to them or is it better than some of them?
Yeah, and they didn't really answer that question particularly, but they did survey 20,000 women in 200 hospitals around 21 countries, and this was published in The Lancet. One advantage of this drug is it is cheap. It's $3 in the United Kingdom, and it costs about 75 cents in Pakistan. So it may be that because it's been around for a long time and it's used to control hemorrhage in cases where other things haven't worked, we need to compare it to existing treatments.
Well,
right?
And also for people, and maybe it's easier because it's cheap, and maybe it's easier because of the formulation to get it into the hands of people in developing countries who are the ones who continue to die from postpartum hemorrhage. So this really is an opportunity perhaps to save lives, and we look forward to learning more about it.
Let's talk about our last research that matters, Christine. It's about placebos and, in this particular case, broken hearts. And we're not talking about the hearts that get broken from pump failure from a heart attack. We're talking about broken hearts from a relationship.
So this is research around placebo. So you guys know, and we've talked about this many times, Adam and I, about sham treatments or the placebo effect, where there are no active ingredients, but we know in studies that taking a placebo can measurably ease pain, ease many, many symptoms when a patient believes they're getting a medication.
And one of the strongest placebos is when you give someone a medication. It has a placebo effect over and above whatever effect it might have on the medicinal effect. And also if you give someone a shot, but also if you touch them, and then even the words you use can all have impacts. We know that.
Right. And so this was a study looking at volunteers who had experienced an unwanted romantic breakup in the past 6 months. So people who were heartbroken, and they were asked to bring a photo of their ex and a photo of a good friend of the same gender to this brain imaging lab where they got MRI tests of their brain to look at how they reacted from the MRI perspective in their brain when they looked at these pictures of their ex person and of a friend.
And then they were given a medication. It was a saline, salt water. But half the group were told this was a potent medication that helps relieve the pain of heartbreak. And the other half just got that the nothing. And the ones who were told that this was going to be a powerful medicine to help them, you know, in their MRIs of their brain, they started looking like the people who weren't heartbroken. And it just was fascinating to suggest, again, now we're not saying we should give a saline injection and say that, you know, what it's going to do. But I think it suggests that perhaps the way we approach an issue can really impact what's going to happen. And we kind of know it, but in this particular case, it's really brought home with this MRI.
Well, I like that it wasn't just how the people perceived or reported their pain, their emotional pain, but that it also was linked to what their brain did. So they physically were feeling less emotional pain related to having gotten the saline nose spray that they believed would help them. I mean, it comes back to, you know, if you do something you believe will help you, it has a better chance of helping you.
And I think as a provider, we can say that.
Expectations matter.
If you have an expectation you'll improve, you will improve more likely. That's a good message.
Yeah, it is a good message. So in the midst, if we're not going to go around giving people placebos, but
it's kind of good.
It's kind of good. Exactly. That explains it all. All right. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Saranya Lair, head of the North America region of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, about how occasionally breaking the rules just might result in better health care. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam, we'll be talking with Dr. Saranya Lair, head of the North America region of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, about how occasionally breaking the rules just might result in better healthcare. What an exciting topic and a fantastic guest. We're thrilled to have you with us, Dr. Lair.
Thanks for having us, Christy and Adam.
Oh, we're thrilled. You know, you're a physician, you have an interest in global health and public health, and you're working for the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. But tell us how you got there.
So I grew up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which is a small town in the Midwest, and my parents immigrated from India. So I spent my academic year living very comfortably in an upper middle class suburb in Wisconsin. And then I spent my summers witnessing some of the most abject poverty in India. And so it was this, I think, struggle between understanding why some people, including myself, were able to access such quality health, education, just liberty, and some weren't, that propelled me into thinking about this question of equity and equality. I work at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, as you said, which is a global organization that aims to work with anyone, anywhere, who's seeking to improve health and healthcare profoundly for the better. And I had the privilege of doing a lot of work with Physicians for Human Rights prior to medical school, where I did a lot of work helping healthcare professionals translate their medical expertise into political advocacy. And then I decided that I wanted to go to medical school myself and be one of those advocates. And what I discovered there was a really profound disconnect between the way in which we knew how to deliver care and how we were supposed to deliver care, and the systems within which we were supposed to deliver that care. And it was probably in one of the many conversations in which I was lamenting about this that I spoke to a friend of mine who was working at IHI at the time. And he said, you know, you should really learn about quality improvement because that's actually the key. And so I started to do that. I started to learn about improvement science and quality improvement and learning about the really simple ways that you could turn everyday frustrations into action and improvement.
Nice.
So I was hooked.
And so I can't wait for us to get into this concept of breaking the rules for better care. But I do think it's important for our listeners to understand. So there's the Institute for Healthcare Improvement that you're involved in, and then the Leadership Alliance. Help us understand what these goals are and how that fits into the context of where we're heading with breaking the rules for better care.
Sure. So the Leadership Alliance is an initiative that is run by IHI. There is a group of about 40 North American healthcare executives and their teams that came together with IHI, committed to working together in creative, courageous, and collaborative ways to advance the triple aim, sort of which IHI calls the triple aim of better health, better care, and lower cost. And so this is a group that took one of the quotes from Dr. Paul Batalden that you might be familiar with, which is, every system is perfectly designed to get the results that it gets. And Alliance members, these North American healthcare executives, aren't satisfied with the current system. So they said, we've got to think about new rules to transform healthcare radically. So they came up with this list of 10 new rules to radically redesign healthcare. They came up with things like changing the balance of power, moving knowledge, not people, creating joy in work, assuming abundance. So these rules sparked some really bold and inventive ideas for these Leadership Alliance members about how to deliver on the full promise of the triple aim. But then actually operationalizing those rules and putting them into practice was a lot harder than they thought, for many reasons that you could probably imagine.
If we're thinking about kind of making things better, you all have one of the kind of redesign principles, which is, I guess, part of the breaking the rules, which is to make it easy. What does that mean? Why is that a goal?
I think anyone who has worked in healthcare, or not even worked in healthcare, if you've been a patient, if you've been a family member, if you've touched the healthcare system at all, you understand how incredibly complex it is for everyone involved, the patients, the providers, the staff, and families. And one of the things that we have believed, and this work, Breaking the Rules, actually, I think, confirms it wholeheartedly, is that there is so much waste in the system that could be eliminated to simplify things for everyone.
Well, help us understand, and we've done this a little bit in the outpatient setting through lean redesign, sort of think about how many times a patient waits in the waiting room and then waits in the next room and then waits in the next room, and try to go through from the patient perspective to eliminate that waste. So that's just one example in an outpatient. But what you did was just much really radical, to ask patients, staff, all kinds of different stakeholders about breaking the rules. Help our listeners and us understand a little bit about what you did there.
Sure. So one of the conversations the Leadership Alliance had, we were talking about these radical redesign rules and how challenging it was to implement them. And what we realized was, I say this facetiously, but we have met the enemy and it is us. Some of the reasons why it was so hard to implement these radical redesign principles was because of the systems that we had put in place. And one of the Alliance members, Helen McPhee, who's the Chief Transformation Officer at Memorial Care, She told a story during one of our calls, and she was describing how there was a young woman in her facility that had experienced complications while giving birth. So unfortunately, the new mom spent time in the ICU, and the newborn was spending time in the NICU. Fortunately, it turned out okay, and everyone went home healthy. And a short time after the mom and baby returned home, Helen and her team asked the woman and her husband to come back and share their experiences as new parents during that very trying hospitalization. The wife and husband, they praised the skill and compassion of the staff. And then the husband said something towards the end. He said, "You know, despite it being against hospital policy, you guys allowed my wife and my baby to visit one another. And for us, we believe it made all the difference, because you broke the rules for us." And it was that phrase, "because you broke the rules for us," that it sparked such a conversation amongst Alliance members, because they immediately could think about all of the different rules that they themselves had broken for their patients, for their family members, the rules that they had broken for themselves. And we realized that as healthcare leaders, there's, you know, that's probably a story that countless healthcare organizations could relate to. And so we thought, you know, as leaders, we often create these rules or policies all with the best of intentions, but that actually do very little to improve the experience for patients, families, or staff. And so if, you know, on this call for 20 minutes, we came up with all of these examples from our own life, what would it mean if we actually asked all of our staff in all of our organizations this question? What would we learn?
We're going to take a break in just a minute, but one of the things I tell to the learners a lot of times, it doesn't always work, but I say the only rule is that there are no rules at some levels. But to emphasize this element here that you've got to be able to challenge, and I'm thinking of my father of blessed memory, who 2 decades ago when he was in the hospital, you know, and they woke him up at 4 a.m. to do his wait, and it was the second or third day he was there, he started screaming at them to get out. They had no business waking up a sleeping patient. And I thought, he's right. And then I was so excited to see one of your, you know, top 10 rules that we need to be broken is don't interrupt hospitalized patients from sleeping.
Exactly.
Why are we doing it, you know?
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you one example from Greater Baltimore Medical Center in Maryland. That was a rule that came up. Someone had said, why do we have to wake up patients who are all, if they are stable, why are we waking them up overnight to take vital signs? And actually, that was a myth. That wasn't a real rule. It wasn't a policy in place. So what the GBMC leadership was able to say is, hey, guys, you mentioned this. You submitted this as an idea that you wanted to break. We're here to tell you, it's not a rule. If that patient is stable, you do not have to wake them up from this hour to this hour. And it made the GBMC leadership really excited and joyful to be able to say, That's not a rule. You don't even have to worry about it. It was a myth that they were able to debunk.
It was a policy.
Fascinating. Yeah, maybe an old policy that then was changed, but people didn't know.
Need to break that
and
policy.
Can you imagine how many of those are probably out there in every one of our organizations?
Exactly. This is such an exciting conversation, and we can't wait to come back to it, but we do need to take a short break. When we come back, listeners, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Saranya Lair, head of the North American region of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, about how occasionally breaking the rules just might result in better healthcare. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Saranya Lair, head of the North American region of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, about how occasionally breaking the rules just might result in better healthcare. And Dr. Lair, you were sharing with us a little bit about your experience at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, or IHI, and also about this experience asking staff, patients, different stakeholders, what kinds of rules they would want to break in order to make healthcare better, or what kind of rules to challenge. And in that, you came up with some common rules suggested for change. I wonder if you could share with us some of the most frequent suggestions to make change for better health.
Sure. Thanks, Christy. You know, one of the most surprising things about this is I think when we said, okay, all you leaders, go ask your patients and your staff if you could break or change any rule in service of a better care experience for patients or staff, what would it be and why? I think there's two predictions many of us probably had. The first was that the vast majority of the rules that people came up with were going to be outside of their control. They were going to be around policies or regulations, things that CMS decreed. And certainly there were a few of those, absolutely. But the vast majority of rules that patients and staff came up with were things that healthcare leaders themselves and healthcare organizations themselves could change. The other thing that really struck me when we got all of the submissions back from Leadership Alliance organizations is, remember, the question was, if you could break or change any rule in service of a better care experience for patients or staff, what would it be and why? And again, the majority of staff, when they said that they wanted to break a rule, what they wanted to do was better attend to the emotional, physical, or financial harm that patients face. So it was about eliminating visiting hours. As you said, Adam, not waking patients up. One of the questions was, why do we have to pay for parking? Why do patients and family members have to pay for parking? That's very stressful for them. Why can't we feed the partners of moms that are in the labor and delivery ward? Really interesting, thoughtful suggestions, almost all of which were, help me take care of patients and their families better. Let me do that. That's what people were asking for.
So let me ask you a question. The title of the article is meant to be provocative, and I think it is appropriately about breaking the rules. But is it about changing the rules? And I'm thinking about we have checkboxes for quality that, you know, one of them is that we've given the patient the, you know, discharge patient education. And I have patients that come back to me all the time. They've got 110, 120 pages in these pamphlets that they've been given. And they say, it's just overwhelming. I don't know what to do with this. And yet we've checked off a box. Do we need to change the rule, or do we have to have just flexibility?
I think there's both. So when submissions came back, they kind of fell into three categories. There were rules that weren't actually rules at all. They were the habits, myths, misinterpretations. So your point about waking folks up in the middle of the night to get vitals, for example, that was an example of a myth. It wasn't a rule at all. Then there were a lot of, the vast majority of them, which were organizational-specific policies that people couldn't quite figure out why they were there. Staff and providers, everyone's trying to do the right thing, and you're trying to follow the rules. That's what we do. But there were so many of them, they said, does this actually need to be a rule anymore? And if it doesn't, can we change it? And that's what a lot of the rules ended up being. And then the final one, there's a small handful that are their regulations. The CMS 3-day rule that requires a 3-day inpatient stay to qualify to go to a skilled nursing facility.
Most important
that's a
thing
rule.
You could change.
And so
yes,
those
kind
of rules need advocacy.
Changed. Yes. Yes.
And that, that is so a, that, that is struck a chord. That one struck a chord with Christy.
Well, it sure does.
We're going to vote on that one right
yes,
now.
We are.
All in
Let's
favor of getting rid of that, eliminating the CMS rule. Say aye.
Aye. Well, the patients know it. It's not appropriate for the patients. It's not appropriate for the physicians and hospitals and teams. And it doesn't have. I mean, it's just no bearing or no purpose in it. So I look forward to your work to help get that changed.
Well, let me just say, one, I think we all can agree that the rules were created with the best of intentions. No one was trying to create a rule to make life more difficult for patients or providers or families. So there must have been a reason for a rule at one place, or there was a problem that they were trying to solve by this solution. So for the ones that require advocacy or, you know, require change, those are ones that you should take to people to create those change. Your members of Congress, your representatives, you can take them to CMS. In fact, we shared some of these rules with CMS, with Patrick Conway and Andy Slavitt at the time, and they were really interested in what we had to say. They were interested in hearing what was working. They were interested in hearing what wasn't and what ideas we had to change it. I received two emails from someone from CMS and actually a member of Congress's staff that said, so I understand that there are some rules that require advocacy or rules that you say are related to regulation and policy. Will you tell us what those are and why we don't like them and what we can do to help?
It's so exciting.
Definitely some hope out there.
The fact that you got you entered this in terms of breaking or changing rules from the perspectives that you did, but also that the Alliance members took action on what you could go ahead and take action on to debunk myths or correct misunderstandings about certain rules, like waking people up at night as your example, but then that you took it to the level of real advocacy with the things that required that. I mean, that is remarkable leadership and from a different angle, which is refreshing.
Let me ask you a question. Based upon your own experience of going through medical school or in public health or having family members be cared for, what rule do you see that really needs to be changed on your end? You know, because for me, it's certainly, and you guys target it, would be administrative waste. And I think about when you get the medical records and you get hundreds of pages and the amount of time that it takes and you're scanning them in and you know that it'll never be looked at again, those kinds of things that we accumulate information, but we don't really, it comes at a cost.
So there's two, I'm going to cheat a little bit and say two. So
sure.
From the patient's perspective, it's any rule that inhibits them from accessing their own information, that inhibits them from understanding their care and those who they designate to understand their care, so their loved ones around HIPAA compliance and that sort of thing. So from the patient perspective, it would be any rule that inhibits their ability to access their own information about their care. From the provider perspective, I think there are too many to mention. One of the reasons that I came to IHI, actually from medical school and public health, was when you walk out the elevator at IHI into our IHI offices, we have sort of a vision statement behind our reception desk. And the very last part of that is restoring joy in the healthcare workforce. And I think about all of the things that providers have to do on a day-to-day basis that add no value to their work, their ability to care for patients, their ability to be good stewards of healthcare. And I think the weight of that is crushing the profession.
Well, that is certainly taking it from the triple aim to the quadruple aim. It is time for us to move towards the end of our conversation, which is hard to do. And I'm thinking, as with each of these, how important it is to touch on every one of them, including patient access just to get the health care. You're talking about access to their medical information. There's also the importance of access to getting health care when they need it from their main provider.
And the cost of that care.
Yep, I know.
Yeah.
It's hard to choose one that's most important. But glad you're bringing it back to the provider and thinking about the full quadruple aim. As you're thinking about leaving last thoughts with our listeners, as they're hearing some of us challenge some of the traditions and some of the rules that have been in modern healthcare, What do you think is the most important thing for our listeners to hear from this conversation today and then act on moving forward?
So I'll say two things. The first is the question itself is really simple. It's a simple question. I do think asking that question takes a lot of courage, and I hope that your listeners and others will be inspired by what 24 organizations decided to do and just try and to do it themselves. What I will say is, if you're going to do this, be committed to it. What you don't want to do is ask people for the rules that they would want to break and then not ever follow through on them or do anything about them. So if you're do this if you're serious. If you're not serious, I think it could be very de-energizing to your patients, to your providers, and to your staff.
Well, we want to thank you for being serious about this conversation, and we should let our listeners know that your essay in the Journal of the American Medical Association, really stimulating thought nationally, hopefully internationally. We're going to put up a link to it on our website. And thank you for that commitment, seeing a problem when you were a teenager and throwing you into college and then to medical school and then now following through on your commitment. We do appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you, Dr. Lehr. We've been talking with Dr. Saranya Lehr, head of the North America region for the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, about how occasionally breaking the rules just might result in better healthcare. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. I'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today. Laura?
I have an arrhythmia that hasn't been resolved with a beta blocker, a calcium channel blocker, or 3 ablations. I'm only in my early 30s, so my EP is hesitant to put me on Flecainide for a variety of reasons. Is there anything else I should consider? I had an acquaintance recommend magnesium oxide, but this person is far from a medical professional, so I'm unsure.
Difficult question, and maybe we should unpack it a little bit here. So arrhythmia means a rhythm. Rhythm is like, you know, dancing, boogieing, that kind of thing. Uh-huh. Arrhythmia is kind of something abnormal. So
right.
It's probably like me dancing, but it's a rhythm of the heart that's abnormal. Lots of different types of, you know, abnormal rhythms. People have heard of atrial fibrillation. We have supraventricular tachycardia. We have the bad ones, ventricular fibrillation, ventricular tachycardia. A lot of names here, but, you know, an abnormal rhythm. Mm-hmm. And then hasn't been resolved with a beta blocker. That's a medication that slows the heart rate down. Calcium channel blocker, that's a medication that can slow the heart rate down. Or 3 ablations. Ablations are, that's like kind of taking that taser to the heart.
Nice. Yep.
You know, electrical stimulation here. Doesn't sound like real fun, but they do give you anesthesia. And so this, by definition, is more difficult, right? Mm-hmm. If it hasn't, you know, if you haven't done the first two things, you know, you build a wall, a higher wall, and then you electrified the fence, and, mm-hmm. you know, people are still getting in, that's a problem. So, and then your EP, that would be our person who really kind of manages things, these electrophysiologists, EP. And then they said, worried about putting them on Flecainide. Flecainide just sounds like a drug that can be really dangerous.
It sounds really intimidating.
Yeah, don't just do anything, but don't take the Flecainide, right? We can imagine that could be a real problem here, you know. And so, and doctors also, by the way, when they hear that word, because they know it's a drug that is a good potent drug, but has lots of side effects. So, is there anything else you consider? Well, certain things that I think Christy and I might consider if we were, you know, in this situation, which is certainly drugs are good, and there are other drugs that this person may not have taken. There's a drug called mm-hmm. Digoxin. It's an old Lanoxin. It's an old standby drug. Great drug,
really?
But a lot of your old time docs know about it. Maybe the newer ones don't know about it so much. Certainly, to see what's more dangerous. You know, these rhythm disturbances, these arrhythmias, have they caused a problem? If they really haven't caused a problem and they're not really dangerous, sometimes you got to just live with them. Maybe there's things in the environment that are happening, whether it be caffeine or alcohol or other sorts of things, you know, that could be an issue. And then finally, a second opinion. You know, mm-hmm. we're always kind of really big about second opinions here. And sometimes finding the right person. This is a pretty specialized case. It may require a specialized center to really see and what's been done and to review it all. So I would take your time. I'd get a really good second opinion. That's probably what I would do.
Great. Great advice.
Hope that's helpful. What's our very next house call?
I'm 65, and I've been seeing my doctor for a decade. 6 years ago, my doctor told me that it looked like I had cirrhosis, probably from drinking too much alcohol and certainly from being overweight. Along with my husband, the doctor met with us, told us the news, and told us there's treatment available. She suggested that I lose weight and stop all alcohol use. It took a year for these recommendations to sink in, but they finally did, and I lost 30 pounds and quit drinking. Amazingly, this year, when my doctor saw me, she said the liver test had improved, including apparently the cirrhosis. I'm telling this story for any listeners who might benefit.
This sounds like, you know, a prayer has been answered.
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah, absolutely. Because cirrhosis, scarring of the liver, which in most cases is irreversible, because usually you don't develop till about 90% of the liver is gone.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, the liver is like one of the most forgiving organs. You can take a small piece of liver, it can regenerate, but and it can live quite well until 90% is gone. But and here in this case, it actually sounds like things have gotten better.
That's
and that's
great.
Because what was driving this inflammation, this scarring, was two things. Weight, which we call non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, fat mm-hmm. around the liver, and then the alcohol, which is a direct toxin to the liver. So what, you know, what great news, what a great message for people out there who are struggling with weight, maybe mm-hmm. have fatty liver disease or struggling with alcohol and alcoholic liver disease, that it could get better if you can make those decisions.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, I think this is one of the cases we want to go out and celebrate, but we want to do it without alcohol, and we don't want it with pizza. Maybe we'll go out and take a walk together.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. I like it.
What's our very last house call?
I've had kidney failure, and I've been on dialysis for a decade. I'm hoping to get a kidney transplant, but when I was evaluated, they asked me if I ever drink alcohol. I said I have a glass of wine each evening, and they said that that disqualified me over concerns of abuse. Do you agree?
Well, that's a tricky question. But it wasn't a trick question, right?
No, not a trick question.
No,
it's a
tricky question.
Yeah.
And that's because, you know, if it's a man or woman, for a man, 1 to 2 drinks a day, 1 or 2 glasses of wine, you know, if it's certainly more than that, it could be too much.
Mm-hmm.
A woman, if it's really more than one on a regular basis, that could be too much.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular case, because you're on a transplant list, they don't want to do transplants for people who are abusing alcohol. Now,
gotcha.
Perhaps they don't even want to do a transplant on someone who's regularly admitting to drinking alcohol. We know
right.
that a lot of people could lie and they could say, yes, I never drink, if they knew that that answer would get them, you know, disqualified. So, you know, I wonder if there's something in this person's past we're not hearing.
Right, if we don't have the whole story.
Right. Perhaps at some point in time they used to have a problem with alcohol abuse or substance abuse. And
mm-hmm.
so the reality is if they're drinking 1 a day, sometimes that could actually mean 3 a day.
Right.
You know, we've kind of seen that. How much do you smoke? Well, I smoke a cigarette a day. Well, now the wife looks at me and, you know, points up a hand with 5 on there.
Right.
So, you know, someone's not quite fully accurate there. But on the other hand, you know, let's take it at face value. Let's say they are only drinking a glass of wine a day. Should that disqualify them? Well, that's their guidelines for that, and we'd have to look at those guidelines
mm-hmm.
and ask our great transplant colleagues. I know we want to talk about transplants more, and we probably should get one of our transplant
That'd
coordinators on the show and talk about these issues, because these are some ethical concerns, you
right.
know, in a limited, scarce resources. Who gets a transplant? Who doesn't? What do they need to do? What, you know, I'm less concerned perhaps about a glass of wine a day than I am about are they taking their medicines every day?
Right.
How compliant are they? What kind of support services? And does that qualify or disqualify?
Right.
You know, so lots of questions out here. I would go back and talk with them and really kind of delve into this. If they really were to say that, you probably could do without that one glass.
Right.
But maybe there's something else going on.
Will they often, in your knowledge, work with you, you know, perhaps this person goes back and says, yes, I do have a glass of wine each evening, but I'm willing to sacrifice that or work with
absolutely.
You on that. And do you think that they would reconsider?
Yeah, know? Absolutely. Even people who have an alcohol abuse problem, if they go 6 months and they've had no sign of abuse, then they can you oftentimes
mm-hmm.
get back
so
onto
yeah.
a transplant
right.
list. I think they just want to say expensive procedure, scarce resources. Let's make sure we have the best chances of success. I'd like that for any procedure, actually.
Sure.
Well, that'll conclude our house call, Sam. We want to thank all of our listeners for calling us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or use our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, the UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great guest today, Dr. Saranya Lair. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.